evening, everyone. This is the Rochelle Sparrow Connection. Welcome, welcome. Today we have a very special guest whom I'm very, very interested in talking about and hearing his story told to you. I know you're going to find this fascinating. His name is Jerry Winstrom. He's an artist. He has a video and a soon-to-be DVD out called In the Hands of Alchemy. You can reach him at www.handsofalchemy.com. And we are going to discuss his book, The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Rochelle.
The most fascinating thing and that I found about your book, and I get a lot of books because people, of course, are always looking to be promoted and to sell their books, so they're constantly sending all of us books. But I got to tell you, I picked up your book, and I don't read a whole lot. I used to quite a while back, but right now I just don't really feel that inspired to read too much that I get. And I got to tell you, I went through your book in 2 days. I just ripped through it. And the reason being, everyone out there, is because Jerry talks about his experiences. And it's not just words that are processed from his experience that have already come to some kind of conclusion, but it's about his actual experiences in his life and about what you have gone through that I just found so interesting. So what I'd like the audience to hear about is your story about what's in the book, about what you did and what happened to you.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, for starters, I think we all have a personal mythos that wants to unfold, you know, sort of the best that is possible for our own personal stories to find their way on the planet, you know, our sense of purpose and what it is we're here to do, you know, in the best possible way. And I think we all have that. So in many ways, my book was a collection of the stories where, you know, the mythology of my own journey kind of manifested for itself and clarified these moments and these directions that I needed to go in. And often, you know, I think as it is for many of us, it comes at a time when we feel most lost. It's when the magic kind of comes into life and redefines the direction we go in. So that being the beginning, the simple version of my story is I was an extremely driven painter. I often say about that time, if I could have painted my way to heaven, I would have done it because I tried hard enough. I had a huge body of work, mostly large paintings. And in 1979, I felt something shifting around all of that. I mean, I couldn't have been producing more than I was producing. And it actually got to the place where, you know, it became quite easy for me to do what I was doing. And it's often at those moments when transition happens, which is what was happening for me. So feeling like this process was no longer serving me, I began fasting, which I did when I needed clarity, and I ended up fasting for a month. It seemed like some real important thing was going on here. And after a month, it became very clear that I could keep doing what I was doing, but it felt like a fear-based choice to do that. And in the 70s, art was like God. It was this sort of false God that was just, you know, I mean, you could do no wrong as an artist, certainly in New York at that time. So that was one of the choices. And the other choice was I could follow this intuitive allurement that I felt would give me everything, but it, in a literal way, it promised nothing because it looked like everything like emptiness. And so on the strength of the literal and the obvious choice, which was would have been fear-based, or this adventurous sense of something greater could really happen here, I gave myself to that something greater, and I destroyed all my art. I gave everything I owned away, and I lived that way for the next 15 years, trusting life to simply carry me in the best possible way it needed to. And so my book is a collection of those moments where the, you might say, reality laid it out where I needed to go in you know, at that particular time. And, and it's told in story form.
What were some of the experiences that led you into a direction of where you needed to go?
Well, you know, it has always been about facing my fears. And so, you know, when you trust life completely without interference, and, you know, and because I leaped in so completely into that possibility, that you can't afford not to pay attention to exactly what is. You know, I feel the clearest indication of the divine in our life is exactly what is. So I wouldn't necessarily seek out difficult situations, but when they came up, I would give myself to them completely. You know, so like an example would be one night, you know, because I fasted a lot, because I gave up all my money, I gave my money away, and when I didn't have food, I didn't eat, and so I didn't necessarily always sleep a lot. My time was my own. I came and went as I wanted to. And so I would often go for walks late at night. So one late night, I went out into the street for a walk, and there was a group of young men sitting on the stoop out in front of the YMCA. And I walked by, and as I walked by, the one who appeared to be the ringleader asked me if I had a cigarette. And I said, no, I didn't smoke, and I continued on down the road. As I made my way, he called me back, and he said, so here was a moment, because I knew they were, you know, in a place that was kind of a little pushy, and so I could have kept walking, but I decided, okay, here's a moment, find out what it's really all about. And so, you know, fear would have said keep going, but trust turned me around, and I walked back. And when I got back, he had a cigarette in his mouth, and he said, you got a match? And I said, no, sorry, I don't have a match, and continued walking. And when I was once again down the street, he said, hey, come back here. So once again, there was that moment of decision, and, you know, and I was I going to give in to fear or trust this moment as perfect? So once again, I walked back, and when I got back, he said, what do you have? And so I used to carry these little boxes of Superman brand raisins for the neighborhood children. They would come running when they saw me because they knew I carried them. And so I reached in my pocket, and I put a little box of raisins in front of each of the men sitting on the stoop, and there were a few women with them who were kind of watching all this unfold. And I turned and continued walking down the street. And so after I got ways down once again, they said, hey, you get back here. And, you know, who do you think you are giving me these raisins? And so, you know, this was a real moment that just felt like I didn't know where it was going. And so I once again turned around and walked back. And when I got back, he was just right in my face and very angry. And, you know, saying, who do you think you are giving me these raisins? And he says, why did you give me these raisins? And in that moment, I just simply went within. And I grew up in a poor, mostly black neighborhood. And here was a group of young black men. And I was able to access and remember and feel the suffering and the difficulty of the young black men I grew up with. And having accessed that, I simply said to him, I was just trying to be kind, but I was feeling all the love and all of the understanding of the anger of these young people. And when I said that, it was really kind of amazing what happened. The women, because it was so genuine, in a sense, having tapped that source, that the women jumped up and surrounded me, and they said, "You be on your way. They don't mean you no harm." And so I just turned and walked. And as I walked away, I sort of glanced at the ringleader who, and I just saw this kind of look of pain go across his face, because the women he was trying to impress, he was disempowered in that moment, and I think they saw him as a bully. So it was a, you know, it was moments like that where you just trust some outrageous possibility of a moment, because the moment is right there and you've done nothing to create it. It's not like climbing a mountain and falling and hurting yourself. You didn't ask for this mountain. It's there and you're just being fully present with it. It was the moments like that where real transformation happened. And what it did was it freed me of my fears of things like gangs or things. You know, the book is full of stories that have to do with facing those fears. You know, just the fear of poverty, the fear of not having, the fear of not having an identity because I gave everything up. You know, I was an artist. I was known for an artist and for producing work. I was showing art. And so to let all of that go, you know, the fear of being nothing or no one, it was the thing that, you know, most of us put most of our energy into avoiding, I had given myself to. So I had to find life in everything that looked like death, in a sense. And that was what that time was very much about for me, finding life unconditionally. I mean, do you exist separate from your identity? Do you exist separate from, you know, the things you have or the things you do or the things you think you are? You know, do you exist if you are nothing at all? And what I found out is we can exist even better.
Most of my listeners know about this dream that I had about 3 months ago. Anyway, it was a dream where I was in a transformation and I was ritually killed in a temple. And I went unconscious in the dream state and I woke up in this lucid dream state on the other side of the veil. But in that sense that I was on the other side of the veil, and in that energy, which I'm still able to maintain now, I can look back from that space into this space, and I see how much we do, how much energy we put into activity to stave off death. And what the true meaning is, of course, on the other side. It's about connection, about how we connect to one another and what we connect to. So that's the synchronicity of the meaning of your particular book to me personally, because your book came after this personal experience that I had. So it was so interesting just reading these particular stories where you went into that energy, because just thinking about how what you must have felt like on the night, I don't know, but I'm just wondering what you felt like on the night when you destroyed everything, like all of your art, gave everything away. There must have been some kind of anxiety, I would think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was sheer terror at one level, and I couldn't do it. You know, there was hesitation. And then when I gave myself to, you know, it's like at that point, it was so clear, you know, between the place of fear or inspired possibility, that there was no way I could just give in to the fear, although it was there. I don't think we ever shake our fear and hesitation, you know, but I think if, you know, we can do what we need to do anyway. And so it started very hesitantly, and you know, and I was afraid. And yet, the more I gave myself to it, the more elated I became. And by the time everything was gone, I was just flying high, you know. But it wasn't without that hesitation. You know, also, there's something about the, you know, and I think if you, just to talk about the death experience, metaphoric death, it's in all traditions. I mean, it's the essence of the Christian tradition, the death and resurrection. I think, or, you know, Yogananda says to set out on any holy purpose and to die along the way is to succeed. You know, we don't succeed by way of our will, intelligence, and good intentions. I mean, the metaphoric death experience we all have to come up against if we're truly living our spirituality, or if we're just simply fully living our life and our dream with absolute fearless openness. We're going to come up against it, and it's in all traditions. It's a, you know, it's in alchemy, the sort of alchemical tradition that Carl Jung worked extensively with. I mean, the death part of it is always comes just before, you know, the transformation. And I think, you know, it's inherent in the nature of reality. So whether we go about it through a particular spiritual tradition or not, it will come up if we are sincerely, courageously seeking all that we can be here.
So it sounds like from what you're saying is that you accentuated and accelerated that wonderful anxiety, that death anxiety that the ego feels, to a point where it was clearly what you were feeling, because it sounds like you sacrificed so much, and through the book there's so much sacrifice. There's sacrifice of food, there's sacrifice of gloves, of keeping your hands warm, there's sacrifice of your speech. But the sacrifice was not necessarily self-destructive,
no.
But it's a sacrifice in terms of opening and knowing that there's an opening to an alchemical experience, although whatever that process is just open. It's just not concluded.
Well, sacrifice means to make sacred. And no one does anything without a reason. I mean, what I at that point, by the time I had given myself so completely to the, you know, the transformation that comes in letting go, that, you know, anything that looked like that, I would give myself to it, because I knew that that's where the real magic came in, you know. And so, you know, I think along with all the stories of sacrifice, there was no real destruction in that everything came back. I mean, including my art. You know, I became more known as an artist, and, you know, I certainly didn't plan this, but I became more known for destroying my art than I ever did for creating it. You know, and I have a whole new body of work because it doesn't matter. But, you know, I think everything I gave up, including 12 years of celibacy, has come back and has been made sacred and given back. You know, and there's a great line in A Course in Miracles, that which is yours cannot be taken away. And I think we're so busy, you know, fearing that what we want and what we have is going to be taken away, that we're not handing it over. We're not putting it on the altar and allowing it to be sanctified and given back to us. I mean, I wanted the same things everyone else wanted in the world, but I knew that I couldn't hold all of that physical reality in place and feel good about life unless it was given by way of a miracle. And it was those miracles, you know, that gave everything back in a sense. And by miracle, I mean it's given back to you because it doesn't matter either way. It doesn't matter if you have it or not. You have given yourself so completely, and you've come to trust the spirit of the journey more than the material having side of the journey. And I think when we can find that place, it's ultimately the place of freedom, and we can have the world because it doesn't matter, you know, in a sense, because it is given back to us. And I'm living on a beautiful island with my beautiful wife, doing exactly what I want, and all of that has come into play, I feel, and it's all held together because of my willingness to let it go. And I, you know, in the cyclical nature of our lives, and this is the gift of having done this one time, is that things, you know, when I get to a place where once again, I, you know, things are going wrong, I don't know how to hold my reality together, I still don't know how money comes or how to do the thing, all the things I'm doing. But when all else fails, between God and I am willing to let it all go again. And it's not like I have to do that now. it's a very quiet moment where you have to mean it, and you know, you might say, between God and I am willing to let it all go, because I continue to value the spirit and the miracle of the journey. And in that willingness, something kicks in and renews it. I mean, I think that's even what it means, you know, in Christian theology of eternal life. I mean, to me, eternal life is like we come up against death over and over again in the cyclical nature of things. You know, there's a time when life is easy, we're loved, everything's flowing, we have abundance. And then there are times when nothing works. Even a word comes out wrong. And I think those are the death times of the cycle. And I think the gift of eternity, you might say, or eternal life, is that when we are in that place in the cycle, what comes through is the ability to remember how to die. You know, that's where if you can die once, you can always die. And it's not like it's an accomplishment or an achievement that's based on your ego's manipulation and strategy. It's more like you've trusted enough that, and you have come to see that you're not running the show anyway, and what comes through is always something larger than your puny little ability to hold reality together or figure it out. And what comes through more as grace and a promise than it does an achievement. And if it comes through as a promise, it will always come through as a promise. You know, and I think fear will never be eliminated, so it's ridiculous to try and buffer ourselves against our fear. But I think what we can do in our fear is also get excited, because we know that that's where the magic happens.
It's interesting to hear you say puny, because that's what my guides are always telling me about, is our puny little selves. We can't possibly imagine what's going on the other side. A lot of what you're saying sounds like the description of the psychological, and of course your own experiences, the processes that you've gone through. But I just want to ask this: all of what you just said, you didn't quite perhaps maybe feel or know when you first started this process. So I'm wondering what acted as the container for your anxiety. It sounded like the more you gave away, the more you became elated. Were there any times when you weren't elated? It sounds like through the book there were some times when that feeling of elation was not a stable feeling.
Of course. I mean, yeah. And again, death will always look and feel like death. I mean, you might say every time it comes around, I feel it all over again. And I think that was a huge part of that journey. And you know, the thing that how I was able to maintain the life is by way of that which continued to carry life. You know, if something didn't come through, if in a sense the gods didn't speak in a language that I could understand, and you know, even physically, if I didn't get what I needed physically, I wouldn't have been able to survive the journey. So what alleviated the anxiety were the gifts along the way, was the world saying all is well, you know, you do what you're doing, you know, it's working. So I think, you know, no one can do it without the miracle. But I think we also, and that here's part of the paradox, we have to be able to hold the unknowing and hold the death, you know. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, most of what we do in our lives is buffer ourselves from that experience. You know, we get big bank accounts, you know, and they're never big enough. We get, you know, more possessions and we never have enough. They're never shiny enough. They're never pretty enough. You know, we do all these things to look like something other than that looming death that's sort of behind us all the time. So a big part of being able to deal with what you call the anxiety is being able to hold it even though it's uncomfortable, to hold the discomfort of unknowing and allow something other, because at the moment when we see death, most of us grab what we want and run, or we go and we just say, well, I can't go there and I'm not going to do that and I have to be safe here, and I, you know, or we do it, and you know, the more intelligent we are, the better we finesse it. I mean, we could look like good little Buddhists or good little Christians, but the fact is most of us, when we come up against that death, we run for cover or we buffer it, and then we act as though we've done otherwise. But so to be able to hold that unknowing, hold the fear, hold everything it takes, you know, in our humanness, to allow the real gift of you know, the gift of transformation to come through in that moment of unknowing, is what kept me going. You know, and finally learning that, oh, I, you know, getting better and better at it, and you know, and what was so interesting about the journey with all the letting go and what you called sacrifice. Finally, when I got to the place in my own journey where I said, you know, what a good boy am I? I can do this. You know, I can do this. It was like that's when I felt the tide change and I was being called back to the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that was terrifying, opening up to the possibility of relationship after being so hugely invested in the discipline of celibacy and coming back to the world and speaking publicly and things happening in the world. That was sheer terror in another way.
Yes.
You know, so that became the challenge.
I was wondering about that because there's a story in the book where you finally get to your island. And you become very, very ill. And I thought, this is about his being really, really terrified of coming out. And there's, of course, there's one, maybe you want to tell it after I'm done talking about it. But there's a wonderful story where Jerry finds this salmon, and it's got a blind eye and one eye that can see. So it's trying desperately to get up this culvert and having a very difficult time. But it sounded like for you it really represented a metaphor of what was happening in your world at the time.
Yes, I mean, and I think, you know, again, death will always look and feel like death. When we're at that place in the cycle, you know, we see out of one eye. We don't feel. We don't, you know, our senses no longer serve us. Our mind no longer serves us. We're just at a place where we're quite, you know, unable to actually make the kind of transition that needs to happen at that moment of death. And, you know, so in that particular story you spoke of, that was really the place where I realized I had to accept coming back to the world. It's almost like letting go of the world was enormously difficult. But then once I got very good at it, I got attached to it, just like I was attached to the world before that. And so I think, you know, opening up to the gift of the world again, which I wanted, but I just, it didn't occur to me that I could actually have it all back at that point. You know, I mean, we all, it's sort of like, I think we just become, we become so attached to everything, or at least I do, you know, everything finally accomplished, you know, there's a tendency to be attached. So it's about letting go over and over. But the gift of the experience, of the original experience, was again the promise. I still don't know what I'm doing, and I still don't know how to let go when I need to in the right way. But I don't need to know. What I need to do, and what I do, is I trust that the gift will carry me when I need it. And you know, you get better and better at it. I feel I'm able to hold it all better. I'm able to hold the unknowing. I'm able to hold the paradox. And the gift continues to come through, and, you know, and that's our eternity. Because if we don't have eternity, what we have is the reoccurrence of death, where once again we have to run from it and buffer ourselves. And, you know, just when we think all is safe and well, you know, here it comes in the back door in a different form and bowls us over again. And so, you know, many of us spend our lives running from the thing that ultimately we're not going to outrun. You know, there's that great Bergman film where there's someone is playing chess with death, and you know, you just don't win that game. All you can do is, in a sense, call its bluff and walk into it over and over. And instead of it being the enemy of our life, it can be an ally in our life where we find renewal.
I want to go back to some of the stories in your book. And one of the interesting things about what I find very true is that when we do our own healing, it affects generations of healing for our fathers, our mothers before us. in ways that we don't particularly perhaps understand or intellectually have knowledge of. But it sounds like for you that was a pretty clear process, especially with in regards to your father. So I wonder if you could share that story.
Yes. Well, it's a kind of a big story. Well, as
we
a
have
young
time.
Man, I like many young men, I fell in love with, you know, the most beautiful young woman in our high school. I mean, I grew up on the wrong side of the tracks, and she did everything right. She was, you know, she was a very bright, good student from a good neighborhood and beautiful. And somewhere, you know, in this reckless, passionate, you know, youthful relationship, she left me, and it completely devastated my life. You know, I mean, I spent many years sort of trying to find that original innocence again, and, you know, and so that was a part of it. And after I'd given everything up, and this was, you know, 15 years later, I was trying to live the celibate life, and my studio at the time was right across the hall from a dance studio, and there were, you know, beautiful young dancers, and one took an interest in me, and she was coming over. I was fasting all the time. She was making this beautiful bread, and, you know, and really, and I was feeling so overpowered by the experience, and I just felt like, you know, I can't do this. You know, I didn't feel I had the power to do what I felt I needed to do, which was to, like, not get involved and not seek, you know, refuge in a relationship when I was in my process of finding out who I was. It felt like it would have been another fear-based choice. And so feeling the weakness of that, overwhelming, also this young woman who this relationship from the past came back to haunt me in the way that it often did. And I just felt completely overpowered by the feminine, by the inability to, you know, come to terms with the feminine. I felt like everything was going wrong. And, you know, and here it was, I gave up everything, and my prayer was, God, how, you know, you have to help me. I can't do this. And so in that very weak place, I went for a walk, and it had just poured rain. And walking down the street, I found a shiny new penny. And I continued to walk, and I remember walking by a storefront and music blasted out the words, "When the rain washes you clean, you'll know." And I knew I was not washed clean at that moment. But walking along towards the river, there was an inlet going into the Hudson River. This was in New York. And I was in so much confusion and pain, I found some strange comfort sitting on that bridge and staring into the water. It was the only place. And at one point, I even tried to walk on, and it was so uncomfortable that I finally went back and just spaced out on the water. I just, you know, in this kind of diffuse awareness, just stared into the water. And while staring into the water, it looked like the way the water was rolling over the rocks, it looked like a woman's body in the water. And, you know, and I thought, God, why am I struggling with women and now this? And so, and also what came at that moment was this intense anger, attachment, blame of this woman for causing me so much pain. And then I would blame myself, and then I would blame her. And it was like a pendulum that was swinging wide for many years, was now just slowing down and almost stopping, and it was like I hated myself, and I hated her, and I hated myself. And finally, it like an epiphany, I threw the penny in the water that I had picked up, and I said out loud to myself, God, don't kill her. And I didn't even know why I said it, and I just was in tears. And when I was able to do that, what I realized, it was myself I couldn't forgive. You know, it was myself, not her at all. And it was such a liberating moment, and it was such an epiphany, because what came rushing back was the fact that I had recreated my father's life. My father was a nice-looking man in his youth, and he had his the side of his face was burned when he was, you know, a young man, which made dating in his life kind of difficult. And when I was 16, I playing with explosives, I blew two of my fingers off. So, I mean, I realized I completely recreated my father's life. And he had married this absolute beauty in his youth. And when he went to war, off to World War II, his wife left him. And I just got, and he was devastated. And I got that, I completely recreated that whole scenario. And my father's first wife ended up dying in a train wreck. A train ran into her car. So here was this death that happened. And what I realized in that moment was that my father couldn't forgive, and he lost the aspect of his own feminine in that train wreck because he couldn't get to the place where he could forgive. And so that moment where all of that information came rushing in, it was completely liberating, because the two things that had power over me was my father, because he always knew my story because it was his own, and he couldn't save me. I can't blame him because he couldn't save himself. And this woman, you know, who had left me those many years ago, those were the two things that held my life in check, and those were the things that I found liberation at that moment from. And to follow up on this, 4 days later, I got a nondescript little postcard in the mail from my first love, who I hadn't heard from in 15 years. And it said that she had fallen into an inlet on that day, and she didn't know why she was sending me this note, but she almost drowned, and all she could think of was me. And so there's another little piece of the story. When I went upstate New York to visit my parents a short while later, my father, who was an alcoholic in his youth, apparently, and I've never seen that side of his life, he became an alcoholic again, like at around that same time. And when I walked into the room, I just sensed something terrible going on, and my mother looked terrible and frightened, and my father looked, you know, really bad from drinking. And my mother explained what happened, and I just turned to my father, and I just really kind of pounced on. I just sort of really called him to attention on what was going on. And I walked out, and, you know, basically what I said is, if you are choosing to die here at this moment, don't think you're taking the rest of us with you. And I walked out, and as I left, my mother was so upset by what I had said, and I just felt this incredible sense of confidence in saying what I said, and I just turned to my mom and said, don't worry, Mom, trust me. And I walked out, and the next day I came back, and my father was visibly shaken, and he was, you know, he wouldn't look at me, and so finally I just walked over and I held his hand, and he said, "What you said yesterday really hurt me." And I said, "Dad, I want to tell you a story." And, you know, my father's a really pretty literal guy, and I told him the story that I just told you, which is a very strange, bizarre story that even I don't get, but it was so completely real. And I told him that story, and he listened with rapt attention. And you know, and at the end of it, I said, "Dad, I feel like you had to marry Mom to pay your dues to the feminine." And I said, "And you've done a wonderful job," because he was a good husband to her. And I said, "You've paid your dues." And in a sense, because I could forgive, because first of all, someone knew his story that has haunted him. And because I could forgive him, because I forgave myself for the same story, I think it was completely liberating for him as well. You know, there's a great saying that I read, and again, it was in the Christian theology, that said when, you know, and I think this applies across the board, whatever, it says when one person in a family is, quote, saved, the whole family is saved. And, you know, to get back to your original question, I think that that is true from this kind of an experience, that if one person just gets the story, you don't hand the shadow on anymore to your children. I know if I had not had that epiphany, that healing epiphany, I would have just married, I would have handed that story on, and my children would have had to deal with it. You know, it's like I think the greatest folly is thinking our children are going to do what we've never done, and it just doesn't happen in most cases. You know, it's like we each have to do our own journey, and then our children will inherit the beauty of our freedom, or not.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of those kinds of instances, everyone out there, of those type of experiences that Jerry had in his book, The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation, which is available on his website at www.handsofalchemy.com. And they are so very, very interesting to read. One of the things that I found interesting, too, is that people sensed that through your own journey and through your own process, that somehow you were a healer, and they brought people to you that really seemed very, very difficult, at least by your description. They were majorly difficult to be around, to communicate with, to handle. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about those instances, especially with the Indian woman.
Well, the healing, it was always about healing the moment. You know, is it the person who's difficult that's standing before me, or is it myself that's difficult for wanting to run away from that person?
Uh-huh.
Now, so healing, it's not like, I never felt like I was a healer. I felt like something would get healed, which would include me, and, you know, and in that healing would be liberation from that particular kind of fear, you know, things like insanity and, you know, like if you remember the story where a very insane woman completely wrecks my place. And, you know, I mean, basically it was fear of my own insanity that I had to come to terms with. You know, and even in that story, what, you know, to find the place where there was a perfection even in that, in a lot of ways, you know, like the story where the woman wrecked my house.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thing, you know, in a way, it was the least beautiful thing. I mean, the woman was so insane at that moment that she smelled bad and looked bad and she took all her clothes off and was screaming and wrecking. And what I got at the clear center of that hurricane was the perfection of it. In a lot of ways, it was the most difficult energy I had ever had to deal with in a negative kind of way. But in another sense, it was the exact same energy as falling in love. You know, when you fall in love, you're just flying. Well, this was like flying on the negative, but you were just as high. You were flying on the, you know, the chaos of this moment. And what I saw is that it's identical to love, and just fly with it and trust it completely. And what happened, again, you know, in a kind of metaphoric death way, the energy ran out. I was able to hand the woman cab fare that someone had just given me to the woman to get home with. And, you know, so, you know, like as a healing kind of moment there, you know, it was my own fear of that utter chaos and material attachment. You know, I mean, I had very little left in my life at that time, but what was left got totally wrecked and broken. You know, so it was like a complete letting go, even of the idea of beauty, because beauty is a hard thing to let go of, you know, when people aren't behaving beautifully or, you know, it's like that. And so even that, because think about the metaphoric death. You know, literal death is going to be more like that than it is like, you know, oh, isn't she just fading perfectly and beautifully? You know, it's like real death is going to be more like letting go of everything we value most, including beauty, because we're not very beautiful necessarily when we die. You know, things do smell bad and look bad and feel bad. And so it's like if we, you know, I think if we can go through death at all levels, we are free of death. And what we get, once again, is that eternity. And I needed, you know, again, that was just another small story where I needed to find that healing in that particular area that scared the hell out of me.
Yeah. It was scary reading it, too. Yeah. Very interesting.
But, you know, since that time, you know, I've had many, you know, people still bring difficult people to me, and I've had many encounters with insanity, And I've come to trust it completely. You know, it's like most of the reason we lock the insane up is because we're afraid of them. You know, if we could really, like, you know, many native cultures, the schizophrenics who would be diagnosed as schizophrenic are the shamans. They're the, you know, they, you know, when they're crazy, but when they're not, they're divine. And I think to incorporate, to be able to incorporate all of it and to be able to hold their insanity and help them in a very compassionate way, and at the same time be able to hear the God talking when they're divine, I think it's a great gift. It was certainly a great gift to me to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's one of the things I am is I have an MSW. I've worked with the mentally ill probably for about 13 years, and one of the things that I've found out is they're actually channels.
Yeah.
You know, they just channel in all this wonderful information that is just mind blowing, and it's wisdom. So they are amazing, and it's just they can't be anything but channels, because of course they're operating in both worlds. So they're bringing both worlds with them, yeah. In terms of, you know, what people might describe as the negative and the positive, along with them, just unfiltered right through. But yeah, it's very interesting. What do you suppose was with you or in you that people brought these people to you?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think the fact that I was just, you know, part of when I gave everything up, I was simply available to whoever came, you know, indiscriminately. And the first to come were the most difficult. You know, there were a lot of street kids coming, troubled people, you know, like I mentioned, the insane. You know, and I think I've come to the conclusion in retrospect that as beautiful as our life is going to be is in direct proportion to how much in the depths we can go in the difficult places. You know, if we can't go too deep and we don't learn to trust, you know, the difficult places in our lives, we end up sort of existing in a kind of mediocrity where nothing really happens. You know, there are no real gifts there, because we spend our whole life treading water, in a sense, you know, covering our bases, buffering ourselves from our fears, and there's no magic, there's no mystery, there's no sense of purpose. We do nothing for no one but ourselves if we live in that way. And so, you know, in retrospect, what I see is that, you know, I don't spend a lot of time in reality that's not very pleasant now. And I think, and in fact, my life is incredibly beautiful, and I think it is so because of my willingness to trust it all, you know? I feel like I have the beauty because the ugly is just is fine just as well, if that's what the gods want to bring my way. So I think they're very related.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to ask you, and that leads to me asking you, what processes are you in now, or are you really confronting anything major that is fearful? Because it sounds like you've been through so many that I'm wondering what's left.
Well, you know, in many ways, and I say this with humility and a little reservation, in many ways I feel like I'm in the celebratory phase of my life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to say there aren't difficult things. You know, like, there's still challenges and things that I get very nervous about. You know, like, I was recently brought into a corporate, to work with corporate CEOs of many major corporations and present, here's a bunch of people who are losing all their money, who are scared, and to talk about, you know, the creativity of loss, which is, you know, if anything, that's what we've been talking about here, finding the creative, inspired moment when all is lost. And so, you know, things like that, you know, there are things, ways that are bringing me into the world that still I'm still, you know, frightened of at times, but I just keep saying yes to it. But generally speaking, you know, I feel at the celebratory place, and very thankfully, I mean, I feel the world is back. And most of what I do now is simply to be present with what comes and who comes and what it is I'm asked to do. And, you know, and I'm doing a lot of art again. You know, I have another, if you want it, a story that's once again related to that first love, that something that happened recently in a new art piece. If you mm-hmm. want, I could tell you that. But that's sort of the kind of things that are happening now.
Mm. What frightened you about being in that environment with the corporation?
Well, being so out of my element, you know, I haven't had a real job since I was about 18. You know, I mean, I don't know the corporate world. All that, you know, I was there because, you know, I actually had a real intense encounter with a very powerful man on the financial scene who was going through a lot of suffering, and, you know, it all worked out well, and he was impressed, and he wanted to bring me into his clients who were, you know, major CEOs. But what was so, you know, I'm out of my element. Like, who am I to be in this kind of, he flew me to New York. You know, it was at this really ritzy place. In fact, I showed up with I had a sports jacket on, but a black T-shirt, and they wouldn't even let me in because I didn't have a tie. I said, well, if you don't let me in, you're not going to have an event because I'm the... I mean, you know, just being so completely out of my element. It was also exciting and fun. You know, so I think just the way life is still calling me back to the world in ways that make me nervous.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like primarily you are on the receiving end of your journey.
I am, and I also don't know that, you know, I feel like I am. I feel gratefully at a place where it's more the celebratory side of life. You know, happily ever after, if we watch a movie and it doesn't end that way, there's a part of us in our very bones that knows it's not the truth. And I think that's our birthright. You know, I think life should end up there, and we all know it. You know, not that we all end up there, but we all know it, and I think that's what we call hope. No matter what goes on, we all know it's supposed to end well. And I feel that is a reality, you know, and I think taking, in a sense, responsibility for the joy of that, of facing our fears, you know, the gift that comes with unconditionally trusting the beauty and the nature of reality, to take responsibility for the good parts, too, is just as important. And I think life really is a happily ever after, you know. And I think, you know, even, you know, getting older, I'm 56 and starting to see limitations with my body, you know. And I think, you know, the challenges there, the surrendering into that, I see that too works. You know, it's like we can, you know, we're all in the best seat in the house exactly where we are, no matter what's going on. And we can, when we have really created the momentum and learn to fully inhabit where we are, I think we can live out the perfection of the moment. You know, I think in a lot of ways it's like in the early days when it was all, you know, happening in such an intense way, which are the stories in my book, it was a bit like learning to dance. You know, it's like the gods are saying, put your foot here, put your foot there. And it's like, it makes no sense. You know, it's painful and ridiculous. Why is this happening? Why am I doing this? It makes no sense. It doesn't look like anyone else's life. And then later in life, you see you've been learning to dance and the music comes on and it gets a lot easier and it makes a kind of intuitive, joyful sense. And I think that's why we need to learn the things we do, because we have the potential for the music to come on if we've learned well, and it really does become a dance.
Mm-hmm. This has been Jerry Winstrom, The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation. You can reach him through www.handsofalchemy.com. I highly recommend this book. It's very, very interesting. And he's also got a video out now and a soon-to-be DVD, In the Hands of Alchemy, which is about Jerry's life and his art and about living his art. So I so appreciate you on the show. You're just a pleasure, and I appreciate your courage and being on your path the way you've been on your path. So I appreciate you being on the show. And up next is Don and Winshow. And thank you so much to Don Newsom and Brother Doug. I love you both. Thank you so much. And thank you again, Jerry.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.